Abjilida nige sixidamuk 7th episode uchid abjila si migmagi ula bilingual migma adlasiewe podcast at nindilwisi Annie Claire. Welcome to the 7th episode of abjila si migmagi, a bilingual English and Mi'kmaq podcast. I am your host Annie Claire. Today on abjila si migmagi, we travel back in time. Let's just step into this time machine and set the date for 1000 AD. Push a few buttons here. And here we go. Go, go, go. Everyone all right? Now listen closely. Can you hear it? It's the sound of no white people! We're back to where we were. Mwe mugwenda wan sikhtadin. Mwere na guldam yao da ba'anwal. Mwe mugwenda wan madnulto. Mwe mugwenda wan sikhtolto. At mojitje makanu, at mega gentek. Oh, kam do jiwole ma. Pesido? Pesido gat nin. E modi, ni edan det e modi ka nagelo. Now with no one bothering us, or giving us diseases, or stealing our lands, we can look after ourselves. We govern ourselves. But what exactly does that look like? Good thing that Roger Lewis, curator of ethnology at the Nova Scotia Museum, is also here to explain things. Hi, Roger. Introduce yourself.
Roger Lewis, and I'm originally from Indian Brook, Shubenacadie.
Trying to understand the roots of our traditional governance, what can you tell me about pre-colonial social structures?
To answer that question, you're going to have to go back to the beginning of before the arrival of Europeans here and understand how Mi'kmaq people lived on the land. In Nova Scotia, for instance, Mi'kmaq people would have been settled on 44 principal rivers in the province of Nova Scotia. Those principal rivers would have had, say, you would have been on one major river, I would have been on another major river. There would have been 44 autonomous family units on these rivers. Now, this is going back to pre-contact time. When you understand the settlement patterns of early Mi'kmaq people, you kind of get a better understanding of what social governance was like. Each one of these individual rivers had their head people, and of course it'd be a structure there. But we would have what we would call those bilateral relationships.
Okay, so we were river people, which makes sense in the Maritimes. Were we patriarchal or matriarchal?
A lot of people say, okay, we're patrilineal people, but I think we're mistaken in that. I think rather than being male-dominated, we're patrilocal. There's a difference. Patrilocal is where your daughter marries my son, so your daughter comes to my river. My daughter would marry your son. She goes to your river. So that keeps the group strong, keeps us connected as kind of bilateral families. You see that on all 44 principal river systems.
Were these rivers organized into bigger governance structures?
I would say yes, there were. People say, okay, we talk about districts. The districts that we know today are Western geopolitically influenced. They're boundaries, like county boundaries. They came into being in about 1812 when the colonial government, imperial government, divided up Nova Scotia into administrative districts. But now, if we go back to pre-contact, pre-colonial times, people say, okay, did we have districts? Yes, we did kind of have districts, but they were based on physiographical geography divided Nova Scotia. If you could run a line across from Yarmouth to Canso, All's Cove up in Port Hawkesbury, that area, if you run a line right across the province, that's what you call a water divide. Then if you came from Amherst, that area down, you'd have the Cobequid Mountains. So those are geophysical boundaries, so it's important to keep this in mind because those are nature's boundary lines. Water flows to the Northumberland, water flows to the Cobequid, flows to the Atlantic, and flows to the Bay of Fundy. So we as pre-colonial Mi'kmaq would understood that. we would know when we crossed into a different territory based on the flowage of that water.
How many of these districts were there?
If you included all of Mi'kma'ki, then we would have 7 physiographic regions that naturally divide up Mi'kmaq territory. So each one of those would have had probably a head person in them. If you look at some of the early treaties, you'll see the signatories of those treaties, the people who left their totems, are those head people who basically came from every one of those watersheds. We had formalized structure, social structure here, political structure. It's just that people didn't really understand today. I think that stayed in place all through the 16, 1700s. Then it started to really kind of weaken and faced a lot of challenges through the 1800s. In the early part of the 1800s, when they established reserves in Nova Scotia, then they started appointing individual chiefs. So 1821 is about the time we see the establishment of Indian reserves as we know them today in Nova Scotia. Shubenacadie, Bear Rivers, Pictos, all those places became reserves. And what's interesting about them, although they're reserves, they're not that far removed from traditional land use areas of Mi'kmaq people. People often talk about acculturation happening over a 200 or 300 year period, but that wasn't really the case because by the late 1700s, we're still living on in traditional land use areas. The Mi'kmaq world in Nova Scotia falls apart rather rapidly in about 3 decades. So now we have colonial appointed chiefs. There are still some remnant of traditional governance, such as what we would call the Grand Council today.
What about the influence of Catholicism?
I've had many discussions with people about that. No disrespect for the Roman Catholic religion, but if we go back to the early French being in the province at Port Royal, when they first arrived on the shores, they came not with Jesuits, but another order when they were baptizing people. Remember, too, in that those folks down Port Royal. It was only a couple of years after that the Jesuits arrived here, and they were horrified that this Catholic order came over and baptized all these Mi'kmaq people but didn't give them religious instructions, so to speak, catechism. When they had the warrants for the monopoly on the fur trade, for instance, the conditions of that monopoly required that they convert and introduce the Catholic religion to the indigenous population here, to the Mi'kmaq people. That was a contract. If you didn't meet the letter of the law, basically, they'd pull the warrant or the monopoly from you. The Jesuits came, and the Jesuits did their thing. But you see the influence on Mi'kmaq people. In some ways, that was a challenge. We talked about that Grand Council structure, and the local political structure on these watersheds was gradually picked apart by this religious instruction, where you would have had the head man, the second in charge, third man, or third in charge, going down. There was an order here. People just didn't run around like with any kind of framework or any kind of social organization.
So it sounds like there was an undermining of our existing governance structure and a rewarding of pro-Catholic alliances.
To accomplish what they wanted to accomplish, the Jesuits had to dismantle some of that traditional political structure. So some of our traditional religious men were being challenged, and their authority was being challenged. If you go any place and you want to dismantle a social unit, you go for the heart of that social unit. So this is the man who carried the traditions and the stories and everything. He was the soul of that group. So you diminish his authority and his influence and his status in the community, then you replace it by something else. Then you've accomplished what you wanted to do.
If we move the story into the 18th century, how is Catholicism mixed into politics in Mi'kma'ki?
Then you see in the British-French conflicts here in Acadie, the church's role. Guys like the Lutra, who comes and establishes a mission in Shubenacadie. A lot of people don't understand about the importance of that Shubenacadie mission in the history of Nova Scotia, even nationally. There was a lot of stuff going on. That priest would influence Mi'kmaq responses against the British. So a lot of political stuff happened at Shubenacadie that continued on through the 1700s, like I say, until the Acadians were expelled from here. It amazes me, and I think, despite, and I want to be careful how I say this so as not to offend any Roman Catholics and stuff, but I mean, I find it amazing that the strength of that conviction to the church is as strong as it is in light of the fact of some of the negative things that the church were committed against Mi'kmaq people. But I guess that's fate. Now, rather than being a political institution, the Grand Council reverts to a religious kind of role in keeping alive the Roman Catholic belief, right? And it's kind of still the role our Grand Council still have today.
Thank you, Roger. I recommend you all to visit Roger Lewis at the Nova Scotia Museum in Halifax, Nova Scotia.
Kelo keng na nige nudo mukke kluso wa ane agunut la Roger Lewis. Pas na nige ke a katte manish koi na deno is Grand Council nige ke gul manish will manish ta wa agunut musi desno nige siya widaik chugida sikt zemuk ha walalio.
To learn more about traditional governance, let's meet our next guest in the time machine. It's Don Awal. Don is a Mi'kmaq historian and genealogist living in Kijibuktuk. Introduce yourself, Don.
My name is Don A. Walton. I'm from Nova Scotia.
What are the historical origins of the modern-day Mi'kmaq Grand Council?
The actual historical ones, as opposed to the myth that they're trying to create. The Grand Council, overall Mi'kmaq, became official in 1919 with the election of Gabriel Sillaboy. The year before that, he was elected Grand Chief of Cape Breton in the area. But the whole idea of a Grand Council overall Mi'kmaq never occurred until 1919.
How is this Grand Council different than historical or traditional Grand Council?
There was never an historical or traditional Grand Council. That's a modern-day myth. The district councils of the 1800s started about around 1820, and they were promoted by a Catholic priest by the name of Father Vincent, who convinced them that, you know, like, if each district or area had their own head chief there, they would be able to negotiate better with the provincial governments.
When did the Grand Council become connected to the Catholic Church?
Well, in the sense, the Catholic Church invented the Grand Council, so it's always been connected with the Catholic Church.
Can you explain what is meant by the Mi'kmaq Concordia, and why does the Mi'kmaq Grand Council support this?
The Mi'kmaq Concordiate there, if you're referring to the one that's supposedly between Member 2 and the Pope or the Vatican, there was never any such thing either, historically. It's just another one of these myth things in that the so-called Vatican wampum belt there that Member 2 made for the Grand Council was never made until about 1830. It was not made by Mi'kmaq, it was made by Mohawk in Ontario, and there's lots of records and evidence to prove a little common sense on you. Look at it, you know, like they point to the seven little hills that are supposed to represent the seven Mi'kmaq districts there. Well, if they actually counted them, they'd find there's six of them. And the church on there, well, Member 2 would not have had any concept of a church, much less one of neo-Gothic design, which never originated around this area until the late 1700s or early 1800s. So if Mi'kmaq, or Member 2 specifically, could have designed a Gothic church for wampum belt in 1610 or whatever there, he should be sainted.
Do any of the women have a role in the Grand Council?
Traditionally, except for grandmothers, women never had a role in Mi'kmaq councils. In the early days there, a grandmother could speak on a council, on a local or a community council. And that was not a reference to an elder. That specifically meant a grandmother. You could be 30 years old, and if you were a grandmother, you were a grandmother. Like, you had to have grandchildren to be a grandmother. Women's roles changed later on, by the time of the late 1800s, early 1900s, when, you know, their basket-making skills and other crafts and things like that turned them into becoming the major income source makers within the Mi'kmaq community, so their status was greatly elevated, I guess, at that time, and has remained so ever since.
What is the point of pretending that the Grand Council has ancient historical roots?
I think it has to do with the perception that if people think it was an old thing that went way, way, way back, they would have more power and more influence politically. With the Indian Act, the government of Canada actually refused to recognize the district chiefs in Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, and Prince Edward Island, you know, imposed their own little system of chief and council on Mi'kmaq. If you go way, way back, Mi'kmaq governments involved a group of bands that were mostly related, each one. They're closely related groups. The structure in there, almost all governance was done by council and unanimous decisions. The person that we call chief now, they never used to call chief. That was their main function, to be the spokesperson for the group. So if you had a group of spokespersons together, it didn't matter if one came from a larger group or a smaller one, they're all the same. In these group meetings between different bands, it was only the spokesperson and perhaps like the local boon that spoke on behalf of your community. Nobody else spoke. That's why you had that person. But before he went into this thing, it was agreed pretty much unanimously within your own group what he would say and what he wouldn't say. Other than that, his power was limited. He couldn't order people around. He couldn't tell a hunter to go hunt or a warrior to go to war. You did that by your own choice, your own decision. Hunters hunted because if they, they realized if they didn't, their families would starve. Not because someone told them to, or they had to, because nobody had the authority to. This is well recorded. It's nothing new. There's all kinds of references to it in the historical record.
What is the danger of the Grand Council passing itself off as the traditional governance structure?
The danger in that is like in claims for Aboriginal title, specific land claims, treaty negotiations. If you're making it up, it's very easy to prove this wrong there. And actually in the courts, the Vatican wampum belt has already been demonstrated to be a fraud. The court didn't see it as an intentional fraud, but saw it as a fraud. So, it undermines our legal position. The whole pan-Indian thing does undermine legal position. If you go west now, say you go to Oglala territory in South Dakota, if the pan-Indian tradition does not originate from Oglala, it is illegal on any of their reserves. If it comes, say, like a medicine wheel from Ojibwe, you're not allowed to have a medicine wheel on the reserve. It's illegal. Because the whole pan-Indian thing has hurt them in the court actions. It has hurt us here in our court actions for Mi'kmaq. Like Marshall and all case there, where the Vatican wampum belt was brought up as an oral tradition thing, it totally undermined it. The credibility of our oral traditions slapped them right down.
How does the pretend history of the Grand Council contrast with our people's actual history?
The real history of the Grand Council is fascinating. Much more interesting than the fabrication. Go with the real thing. It doesn't undermine anything. Governments and people, they evolve. The system that was in place there, for Mi'kmaq, say, 400 years ago, it wasn't capable of working by the 1800s, 2 centuries later. So, four centuries later, even less so. So you evolve, into a type of governance that will work. At the same time, you recognize the limitations there. There's a big disconnect between chiefs and Grand Council over the treaties there. Most Mi'kmaq know that the treaties belong to them, but, somehow the chiefs think that if they're elected, they can negotiate the treaties. They don't have that right. It's not their treaty to negotiate.
Thank you, Don.
You're welcome.
As Mi'kmaq fight for our treaty rights in the 21st century, it is extremely important that we know our own history. If we don't, the results can be disastrous. For example, in 2001, in the Nova Scotia Provincial Court, Stephen Augustine attempted to represent a wampum belt he claimed was made in the early 1600s. Augustine said that the belt represented a link between the Vatican Church and the Mi'kmaq nation. A crown witness went to the Vatican and found conclusively that the belt had been made in the 1800s, and it was a gift from the Mohawk nation to the Pope. This serious error undermined the entire case, as well as the credibility of our own oral history in Canadian courts of law. The attempt to grant Mi'kmaq people logging rights under treaty was eventually lost.
Kemukmaligodumunesh, tangoi maunudaika, atlimanesh mimajuinuk, tangoi delia awe, edenudadesnuna ula, at modeltenuk, maligodumun. Genegeabjidanesh, 2016. Aji 61 is Dabuji Jinamuk, Damaju Kwadimidish Negamok, Grand Council, Modern Day, Delwisijik, Russell Julian, Ron Nakut.
Okay, let's get back into our time machine and set the date for 2016. Our destination is a Nervin big stop in Enfield, Nova Scotia, where we will be speaking with two members of the modern day Grand Council, Russell Julian and Ron Nakut. Hang on!
I'm Russell Julian from Indian Brook, Municipal.
And Ron Knockwood, also with the Grand Council.
Can you tell me about yourselves and how you became a Grand Council?
Just being a good Samaritan and helping one another in the community, and people see it and then bring you into the circle of where you should be respected more than to help more people and help your people.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was it was community driven. It wasn't no election, nothing like that, nothing like you see in the elected politics. It was lifetime commitment to your people and doing what's best for your people, and that's how they seen us as people that were out there trying to do what was best and doing good things and keeping your nose clean, you know, throughout a long period of time. And then when I was asked, it was one of these things that, well, I don't know if I want to do it. That's a strong commitment. So, you know, instead of jumping at one foot, I said, I'll jump in with two. But I had a long talk with my mom, who is an elder in the community, with the local priest, who was sort of driving it at that beginning. And we'll talk more about that later on. And the grand chief, the current grand chief out of Unamagi, had a great discussion with them before I made a decision to go, because it is a lifetime commitment. And when I went into it, and that's what we committed to. So, and here we are.
How does one become a Grand Council member, and what responsibilities do you have to be accountable to the Mi'kmaq people?
That's the biggest question we're asked on a regular basis. When we first got in, Russell and I, one of our first meetings we went to, and we asked that question, what is our role? Because we were new to it 10 years ago. And I was a little upset because I got five different answers from five different captains. And my thing was, well, someone has to be right. What kind of education programs do we have out there? You know, we know the commitment to the people. At the time, when we were there, it was more driven by the church. It was sort of leaning that way, because if you go back historically, you see how the Grand Council was pushed out of mainstream politics by the government or the British Crown at the time, pushing us away in order to get the current system they have in place. There's a whole lot of studies that we're working with St. Mary's University now to sort of uncover, expose, and do that kind of stuff. So they've seen it as a church, and you can see why the church was involved with it, because where did the Grand Council go after it was pushed aside? Back, you know, from the early 16 right up to 1958, you can see where it went, and it was under the church that the Grand Council sort of survived its way through. And when our role, like, again, is being good people, of doing, helping people in your community. And we've seen it more as we went along in the Grand Council as being more than just church. We have a political responsibility when it came to the treaties. You know, people call us treaty defenders, keepers of the treaty. And we took that seriously in regards to how can we best utilize that treaty, make sure it doesn't get abused further down the road. Because we see it as people using it now, and the way they're picking at it and taking, you know, one or two components out of it and sort of putting it on display or putting it in the courts, where when you go to court, you either win or you either lose. There's no in between. So unfortunately enough, we've been winning, but there's a chance that if we lose, then what happens? How do we progress that? So that's a role of the Grand Council. You know, the church role, I mean, is still prevalent in a lot of our members. A lot of guys see that as the only role, and they do good things within the church. When I say church, I'm saying community also, because it's part of community and other community aspects of just volunteering and being good people, of helping anybody, doing visitations of elders, going doing presentations with young kids and stuff like that, in order to just to be good people and be proud of who you are.
And then the other thing to add to that, like Captain was saying, we owe the church, the missionaries, a big an apology for helping and saving our treaties. It wasn't for the missionaries, we wouldn't have had our treaties where they're at today, because they kept them and they stored them away. When we went to the Supreme Court, they pulled those out and said, you're going to need these to win your cases. And people don't see that. They see them as abusers. Yes, they did abuse our people, but yet they also apologized. And my dad is another also in my community, which is the oldest man in Indian Brook. He was saying, now let's move on. They apologized. We got our money. Now let's move on to the next page. Let's get on to the future to betterment our people. But keep it in mind, you're Innu. You're Indian. Don't forget that.
And I think that's where the Grand Council comes into play. We have to sort of put the information out there in regards to, yes, you got the bad side. You see it in news, and you watch it on TV all the time, and you see people suing, and you're seeing people getting compensation and all that kind of good stuff. That's fine. But on the other side, what is the other side of the coin? What role was played by, where the church, where the federal government, or whatever it may be? Was there another role of what has happened and what we got out of it in a positive way? But nobody wanted to see that because, you know, at the end of the day, people are being compensated in financial dollars. And every time you put a financial dollar in place, it causes people to think different. All of a sudden, a different mentality takes over. You put money in front of any group or race of people, you're going to have people that want more than anybody else. And that sort of happens. It happens because I wasn't in the Grand Council, but when they did the $350 million for residential school survivors, I was in BC at the meeting. And one of the comments I made at the time was, I don't like compensation because if we give people a lot of money that were in a situation that they have no control or had no control over their lives at one time due to alcohol or whatever it may be, or drugs, and never had any kind of financial support or background, that they could harm themselves. And I feel we made harm so people more so then if we don't take proper procedures. And today, I can tell you, at least five people, just the top of my head, that when they got their money, an extreme amount of money, that they're dead now. Some people are doing well. You know, not saying it's all bad, but because there has to be a balance. And we never really met that balance. So when we talked about some of the stuff like, okay, we see the bad. We see it in the news. We see the government giving in to it. On the other side, tell me something that's good that's happened. You talk to some of the elders, they'll tell you. We did get education. We did learn to read and write. We did that stuff. You know what I mean? And now today, like, we're even progressing further into having more people in getting educated in universities, going beyond of what was expected of us in the past. Savages is what we were called. But now, we can compete with anybody. Where did that originate from? Was it our teaching? Maybe the moral value of it, that traditional value of surviving. But that academic style education didn't come from our people originally. It came from somebody else. So we done well, but nobody wants to highlight that. And that's where we come into play, say, as Grand Council, to try to give you that sober second thought of, okay, what is that balance? What is out there? What has happened? And sometimes when we do, people don't like to hear it because it is real. It's a lot of it's fact. When it comes to the treaties, it was the Grand Council that signed that. It wasn't the elected officials. So that's where we're coming in, and we're saying, hold on, chief and councils. So that's the role of the captains, and, you know, they take on this. And then we take it to the Grand Chief, and we say, this is what we want you to do. And I think we're just in a matter of time before you see quite a shift in the Grand Council in regards to taking a more active role in especially the treaty issues, the fishing, the hunting, you know, the fracking, if you wish, or the salt caverns here in East Hants, this sort of stuff, and how we want to deal with that. Because everybody we talk to, they come to us as captain, what are you going to do? You're a captain of the Grand Council. What are you going to do? What's your role? And we sit back like we don't have all the answers. But as a role as a Grand captain of the Grand Council, you take that information back and then you share that information with other captains. And again, you try to come up with some sort of idea of how you want to deal with it. Because right now, if the way, and I explained it to some of these guys, is that a lot of the interpretation of what's going out there is done by legal heads. And that shouldn't be the people dealing with our issues. Because what they do is they'll take one component of the treaty and put that on display in the courts. And I have a really hard time with that because if that one display is defeated, it doesn't have an effect on all our treaty. But if we can go back and do our research on our treaties like we're doing now, I think it make that a whole lot stronger that when we do go, that they just can't take any little component out of it and put it on display. And, you know, when we went to Osibuktuk and we talked about the fracking and some of the civil disobedience that was taking place there, we were on the road, and I said, well, the biggest thing is, I said, what you're doing, what's effect is it going to have on the peace and friendship treaty we have in place? Are we now breaking our own treaty? You know, let's be smart. You know, let's talk about this. Let's open the door and let's find out what's the best option. We have to have options in order to defend. And a lot of things was research. Yeah. And I think that's about one of the biggest roles of the Grand Council that you asked earlier, was that second sober thought, that balancing of what is out there today and what's being done and why it's being done and the long-term effects of what we're doing today.
Thank you, Ron and Russell.
To my listeners and my guests, I will say this. For 500 years, we've been battling with people for everything we stand for. It's understandable that after so long, we've internalized the shame into ourselves that the colonizers want us to feel. Our ways have been buried, but they are there if we look for them. Instead of pretending that we are something we are not, Change will come when people are honest with themselves and each other. We do not learn from history by inventing it.
Mega wegi wulalio dandel siksinuma. Ke dawju mududio. Gina mugunjanwa dandelia away. Up numul toksu.
Thanks and we'll see you on the next episode. Up of Jalasi Migmagi.